In a landmark ruling today, the Supreme Court said the worker language of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 also protects LGBTQ Americans from discrimination. Joining us from Washington is WBUR senior news correspondent Kimberly Atkins. Kimberly, welcome back.
Hi, nice to be back.
So let's jump right in. Tell us more about the ruling by the court today. What did it say and to whom does it apply?
Yeah, so it's a 6-3 decision, and it is a landmark ruling, as you pointed out, saying that Title VII, the federal law that protects against discrimination in the workplace, that its wording that discrimination is prohibited because of sex also applies to gay and transgender workers, extending that protection there. And the opinion was written by Neil Gorsuch, who was an appointee of President Donald Trump and is one of the most conservative justices on the court. Like I said, it was a 6-3 decision. So Chief Justice John Roberts also joined with the four more liberal justices of the court to make this ruling. And they based it really on the language of the statute. Gorsuch said it was quite simply that Congress was clear that it said that an employee's sex cannot be a factor in deciding whether to fire them. And if that decision was made because they were transgender or because they were gay, that it qualifies as because of sex.
So what's the impact on a place like Massachusetts, Kimberly, one of 21 states that already protected LGBTQ workers?
Yeah, so states are always free to pass more restrictive anti-discrimination laws than on the federal level. Certainly this applies for employers, for example, big employers who have workers inside and outside of Massachusetts. This applies to all of them, the employers who qualify under Title VII. And certainly this also is a signal, right, that if for anti-discrimination legislation that was aimed at barring gender discrimination, you have this ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court that says, hey, when you say gender, that includes transgender individuals, that includes sexual orientation. And so certainly that will have broad-ranging policy implications in the future when legislation like this is drafted. So it's still a big deal, even in states that already had these prohibitions at the state level.
So I know the court doesn't time its announcements with current events, but this ruling comes, it's during Pride Month, after a weekend of Pride events and protests around the country calling attention to violence against transgender people of color. Boy, it sure feels timed or timely.
Yes. Look, the Supreme Court does not work on the schedule of public opinion or public events. But the Supreme Court, these are nine individuals who are very aware of what's happening in the world around them. So with a caveat that June, it's also June, the big decisions of the U.S. Supreme Court almost always come down in June because you have the justices writing these opinions. They're usually split in some ways, although this one's a little more lopsided, 6-3. But to give the justices time to write dissents. Justice Samuel Alito wrote a 100-plus page dissent on this case. So that clearly was a reason why it was one of the last cases to come out. But I'm sure the court is aware of what an impact this had. You know, the same-sex marriage case was the same thing. It came out in June. It was Pride, and it was seen as a big victory for the LGBTQ community. So, you know, there are some other cases that the court didn't take up that might have to do at least in part with events going on. And I think we'll talk about that a little later.
Yeah, you just referred to the 6-3 vote as lopsided. For court watchers, was it more lopsided than people expected? Was the vote surprising?
I think it was. I mean, in recent years, including the same-sex marriage decision and the decision on DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, we had very split 5-4 decisions, as close as you can get on this court. And it was, having sat in on the arguments of this case, the Title VII case, it was very clear that the court was appeared to be split again. Neil Gorsuch, who ended up writing this opinion, questioned, while on the one hand he said that the workers had a point in their claim that sex does apply to the LGBTQ community, he questioned whether there would be, quote, massive social upheaval, end quote, if the court ruled in favor of the workers. So there was an expectation that this would be close, but with not one but two of the court's more conservative justices joining in, this was a nonpartisan, non-ideological ruling that really focused on the language of the statute.
So after the break, we're going to add a voice. We'll have Judge Nancy Gertner join us to do some analysis. So we'll come back to this case. But before the break, I do want to ask you, what else did the court decide today? Two other cases.
Yes, there was two. There were two other rulings. One involves efforts to run a gas pipeline near the Appalachian Trail. It was sort of a technical ruling deciding whether that land was ruled by the National Park Service or whether it was ruled by other agencies. The court found essentially that the pipeline can go through. And so that certainly can have an impact on this case and in other areas where the court might want to seek the federal government might want to seek the ability to lay gas pipelines. The other was a Strickland case that involves ineffective counsel in a criminal case. And the court held in an unsigned opinion that in that particular case, the defendant did not get adequate representation by counsel, and they just sent it back down for further proceedings.
So in our last 30 seconds before the break, you said June or when the big cases come. June's not over yet. So what's left on the docket for the court to release?
Yeah, many cases. There are more than a dozen cases, including the fate of DACA, which President Trump rescinded, that order that allowed young dreamers to remain in the country legally to work. Also, cases involving abortion laws that are being challenged in a number of states, including Louisiana. So there's a lot to come.
We have been discussing news from the Supreme Court today, especially a landmark decision that recognizes LGBTQ workers as protected under the Civil Rights Act of 1964. WBUR senior news correspondent Kimberly Atkins stayed with us through the break, is still there, and now joining us on the line as well is WBUR legal analyst Nancy Gertner. She's a retired federal judge and a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School. Judge Gertner, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Great to be on.
So, Judge Gertner, I do want to start with you. Your first reaction to today's decision affirming LGBTQ workers are protected from workplace discrimination.
Well, it was a surprise. It was a surprise, not something one would have anticipated by the oral argument. But then again, oral argument doesn't necessarily forecast what's going to happen. It's very interesting. It's Justice Gorsuch. Doing what he has done before, which is to say, let me look at the language of this statute, and we're not going to look at what the drafters had in mind. We're just going to look at the words. And when you look at the words, he says, the way he put it was wonderful. If there are two employees who are, one is a man and one is a woman, and if the employer fires the man just because he's attracted to men, when the woman who's attracted to men doesn't get fired, it's discrimination because of sex. He took the language and said, you know, this is what it means. And I'm not going to look at what people intended.
Kimberly Atkins, let's have you jump back in here, too. Just a reaction to what you just heard from Judge Gertner.
Yeah,
I know you were there when arguments were laid out.
I was, and you could see Justice Gorsuch really questioning on both sides of this, which had some Supreme Court analysts like me wondering if he would play a central role in this case. I was a little more skeptical that he would, but that's part of the parlor trick of trying to guess what the court will do from oral arguments. But yes, he took a very strict statutory interpretation approach to it, not casting judgment in any way about whether this law was right or wrong, but just saying it is what it is and this is what it said, and setting up that big dissent from Justice Alito that said, no, absolutely not. When this law was passed in the mid-60s, there was no way that Congress intended for it to apply to gay and transgender people. If it had, it would have said so. But the approach by Gorsuch won the day, won the Chief Justice, and along with all of the more liberal-leaning justices on the court.
Judge Gertner, strong language from Justice Alito and a lot of pages. What about that? Is this a deeper fissure in interpretation among conservative members of the court?
I don't think it's a deeper fissure. I mean, I think that both sides want to call themselves textualists, you know, people that you're bound by the language of statutes. And because Congress is an institution of compromise, language often doesn't really help because the language is all over the map. You put things in legislation for the purpose of satisfying your opponents. And so Alito was saying here, there was a statute a couple of years afterwards which intended to broaden Title VII, the discrimination statute, to include gays, and it failed. And so that suggests that the drafters didn't intend to include gay and transsexual people, to which Gorsuch responded, I don't care what they intended. We are not supposed to look at what they intended. That's been a debate that the conservatives have had for the longest time. We look at the words. And Gorsuch's opinion is filled with stuff from the dictionary and also makes really a very interesting point, which is how even if it's you're discriminating against a lesbian because of her lesbian, her sexual preference, you're still doing it because she's a woman. The same preference in a man would not have occasioned dismissal. So it's... It was a surprising decision, but in one sense doesn't stray far from Gorsuch's view. In one sense, Alito and Kavanaugh are more straying from their view that you don't look at what the legislators wanted to do, you look at what they did.
So there were multiple cases being considered here, two dealing with gay rights and one dealing with transgender rights. As I understand it, all are covered under this ruling. So how significant is this, Judge Gertner? And then, Kimberly, what are you hearing about it in the halls of Washington today? Judge Gertner first.
Well, it gives a plaintiff who is discriminated against or claims to be discriminated against two forums that they could go to, which is state court or federal court. And the advantage, and in many states, there's not a state call alternative. And that can affect what the remedies are, that could affect what the rules are, and so that can make a difference in terms of outcomes. It also, it gives the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission jurisdiction over gay and transgendered claims, which means they can investigate and use their resources. So it really makes a difference in terms of the general movement for gay rights and transgendered rights in ways that we didn't have before.
Kimberly, what are you hearing about it in Washington today?
Yeah, so in Washington, among the Democrats, the Democratic lawmakers that I've spoken to today, they cheered this case, but also said this is some fuel in their push to pass the Equality Act, which is a bill that would prohibit LGBTQ bias in a number of areas, including housing and public spaces and education. This bill passed last year in the House and went to the Senate and went nowhere. So it renewed the push to try to get Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to put that bill to a vote, essentially saying, look, this is the way that the law is moving. The Supreme Court here shows that LGBTQ rights deserve the same amount of respect as others, and so Congress should explicitly say so, not just when it comes to employment, but in other cases as well. And also keep in mind that this ruling comes a week after the Trump administration rolled back protections for transgender individuals in a couple of arenas. One, when it comes to anti-bias provisions in the Affordable Care Act, and also anti-bias provisions in housing under HUD. So you have this sort of tension here now. On the one hand, the Supreme Court extending these rights, and on the other, the Trump administration ruling them out.
So, Judge Gertner, this is a major victory today for LGBTQ Americans, but there are other cases yet to come before the court involving LGBTQ rights. Any signaling from the court in this result for those other cases?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that, for example, we've seen the court come down on the side of the masterpiece cake makers, the cake makers who didn't believe in LGBT rights and didn't want to make a cake for a gay couple. And so this is a bit of a patchwork quilt. There are other rights that trump these rights. In addition, let me say one other thing about these cases. Oftentimes the first cases that get to the Supreme Court are the clearest fact patterns, right? Because the people doing the discriminating didn't think there was any ambiguity about it. So you'll say, I'm going to fire you because you're gay, or I'm going to fire you because you're transgendered. Going forward now, these cases become much more complicated because knowing that it's illegal to do this explicitly, employers will do it implicitly. And then you have complicated proof problems, which means, in fact, that Title VII is oftentimes not successful in courts because employers can say, I fired you because of this or that and not because you're gay. So the implementation of this could be a problem.
Okay, so let's shift gears because there's some other things going on with the court right now that are interesting and deserve a little analysis. The court decided not to take up the federal government's challenge to sanctuary cities and states. What do you make of that? I'm asking both of you, and what does it mean for the long-running tension between the administration and those sanctuary cities and states? Maybe, Kimberly, you can start there.
Yes. I mean, the one thing about cert denials, which is what it means when the court declines a request to take up a case, is that they don't say why, that they don't take up the case. And that's convenient for them. So we're only left to speculate as to why that isn't the case. We do know just from watching history, I know from my 10 years plus covering the Supreme Court, that if there is a way for them to avoid deciding on a controversial issue, they will. So perhaps it was because it was focused on this one case. Perhaps they just didn't see, you know, they didn't have the circuit split, so to speak, to really, when you have a law that's being interpreted differently in a bunch of different places, that's an incentive for the Supreme Court to take it up. Or maybe they just didn't want to touch this hot button issue among all the other ones that they have on the docket this term, including abortion, including other immigration cases, and this discrimination case. So it's a big mystery, but it's still newsworthy that the court took a pass.
Judge Gertner, I want to know why, though. Do you agree with the...
I agree with Kimberly, but let me say one other thing also. This is a docket that is chock-a-block full of cases involving the president. What the Supreme Court has been willing to do is have expedited, quick review of a number of cases that otherwise would have wend their way through the courts of appeals. So it's an unusual docket because there are so many challenges to presidential power and presidential action. So one very quick explanation may be, enough already. We have enough about this president, and let's do other things. But really, they have been, their definition of an emergency, which means skipping the various courts of appeals to go directly to the Supreme Court, is far broader than any court that we've ever seen. So it's an active docket in extraordinary cases, and maybe they wanted to leave more room to do those.
And what about the court also declining to take up multiple cases regarding the Second Amendment and state gun laws? What do we make of that?
Well, that, yes, includes two laws in Massachusetts. One was the assault weapons ban that was modeled on the former federal assault weapons ban. And another was a licensing law involving public carry, when and how you can carry your gun outside of your home. There are a bunch of cases. The court declined to take them all. We thought that this one might actually get taken up because Justice Kavanaugh said in a previous dissent that he thought it was time for the Supreme Court to revisit its Second Amendment jurisprudence because he thought that state laws were going beyond the court's ruling in Heller, which established that individual right to keep a handgun in your home. It turns out the court didn't have enough votes. You need 4 votes to put it on the docket. The court didn't have it. So perhaps the push to put this to review these cases gave Kavanaugh and Justice Thomas just the ability to lament in dissents that the fact that the court is not taking up these rulings. Justice Thomas said it would be different. This court wouldn't hesitate to take up a First Amendment challenge and didn't understand why it's not taking up the Second Amendment one.
Go ahead, Judge Gertner.
No, I think that that's right. I mean, I also think that the court is split on it. I think that what Kimberly said is exactly right, that the court is incredibly split on those cases. And, you know, whereas Heller established a principle under the Second Amendment, the application of the principle has in fact been fraught in court. What comprises regulation that fits the constitutional standard is a fraught question, is not an easy question. And that may be the reason why you can't get an alignment to support cert. It's just not an easy question.
So, Kimberly, we said earlier that DACA is still a decision pending. Can you explain to us briefly what is before the court? What's the question?
So DACA was the Obama-era rule, executive order, that gave the legal status for people who were brought here when they were very young children illegally to stay in the country, to work, to go to school, to join the military without fear of being deported. President Trump rescinded that when he came into office. And the question is whether he had the proper authority to rescind it the way that he did. Of course, hinging on that is also whether the Obama administration had the authority to put it into place. It has a really big impact. Upward more than 700,000 individuals would be affected under this ruling, more than 5,000 in Massachusetts alone. So it's one of the most closely watched cases. It was one of the first ones that was argued. And so it's going to make a big impact when it comes down.
And Judge Gertner, anything you're expecting from that case, and also anything you saw today that changes what you might expect from that case when it comes down?
I don't think so. I mean, I think the case today, I mean, that's what I was saying about Justice Gorsuch's position. It is not, his position is not a political position, or not in, except perhaps in other cases. It's not political in the sense that this is a principled position that he has, that words mean what they say. The DACA case raises a whole different set of complexities. So I don't think that one case predicts the other at all. And I won't offer any predictions on DACA. I have no idea one way or the other. Sorry.
Kimberly, I got to give you a chance to jump in if it's okay. Kimberly, you feeling bold? You want to make any predictions?
I am not. I mean, it's really hard to make a prediction of anything, especially on a case like this, as complex as it is, as Judge Gertner correctly pointed out.
All right. That's Sorry, Kimberly Tim, yeah, Atkins, we... WBUR. That's okay. It's very unsatisfying, I have to tell you both. Kimberly Atkins, thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
Always a pleasure.
And WBUR legal analyst Judge Nancy Gertner, thanks so much.
Okay, take care.
Our national reckoning over race in America has renewed attention and opposition to monuments, both nationally and locally. A statue of Christopher Columbus in downtown Boston was beheaded last week and taken down to assess the damage, spurring calls to permanently remove the statue by local indigenous groups. There was also a renewal of long-standing push to change the name of Faneuil Hall and a petition to remove a statue of Abraham Lincoln and a kneeling black man in Park Square, which is a replica of the Emancipation Memorial or Freedman's Memorial in Washington, D.C. So we're going to have a discussion about that for the rest of the hour, and we want to know, what do you think? Do you feel strongly about any of these three monuments? What role does a monument play in the life of a city? Who should get to decide what we memorialize and how? And what's the right way to have that conversation? Give us a call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got some callers already, and I want to get a couple of voices right off the bat. We've got Michael on the line from Framingham. Michael, go ahead.
Hi, how are you today?
Well, thanks, Michael.
I'd like to talk about, you know, these statues that are taken down in Boston in respect to statues they've taken down across the country. Now, they're taking down statues across the country that are Confederate statues. These Confederate statues are traitors to the country. Columbus wasn't a traitor to the country. He did good for the country. Lincoln was our greatest president. There's no reason on earth that his memorial should be touched. And
Thanks for that call, Michael.
I think that the people that are doing it should be prosecuted.
All right. Thank you for that, Michael. It's a good way to start our conversation. I want to get another voice in here. We've got Beverly on the line from Watertown. Beverly, what's your thought?
Well, in response to what the first caller said, I think the reason that the Lincoln statue is an issue is because a part of that statue is a portrayal of a crouching slave at his feet. I think that may be the issue. I want to say, though, my opinion, I am ambivalent about it, which I usually am not in terms of matters of race. I'm African-American, but one of the things that concerns me about taking down the statues is that it's not going to change. Well, I can't, speaking only for myself, it would not change the quality of my life substantially as a black person if, you know, certain statutes came down. Now, I know I have the benefit of not living in the South, surrounded by Confederate statutes, but I really would like there to be real, substantive, physical change, economic change, rather than the statute. I would be happy for all the statues to stay up as is if people would get to the real deal, which is justice.
Beverly, thanks. Thanks so much for that call. So two really helpful calls and some different views. In an interesting way to start the conversation, and we have a guest to help us have this conversation today. It's Michael Jeffries, Associate Professor of American Studies at Wellesley. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Michael.
Thanks for having me.
So I thought it would be interesting to give you a couple of caller voices to react to right off the bat. So let me invite you to do that. What did you hear, and what do you think about it?
Well, I actually liked the distinction the first caller made about the Confederate statues and his insistence, really, that the Confederacy is a kind of a different consideration because they really were traitors to the United States. And I think that point stands. The other part of the point that the first caller made, though, really does ask us to evaluate the moral and ethical and political contributions that each one of these figures made. And with respect to Christopher Columbus and the notion that he did nothing but good for this country, I think the historical record shows otherwise. If you're talking about the experiences of American Indians, Native Americans, or really a kind of pattern of enslaving people and mistreating people under the kind of dictum and the objectives of a colonial system. So I think there are two considerations here. One is strictly moral, and one is really political when it comes to what did the Confederacy stand for versus the United States. And then on the second point, that distinction about symbolic versus substantive change is absolutely correct, but it doesn't mean that the statues themselves don't influence the way that we move through our city and the ways that it feels to live in the shadows of these monuments.
So what does a public monument signal? You just said it doesn't mean it doesn't signal some things to us. What does it signal?
Well, I think that in some cases, the signals are really unambiguous. Statues that commemorate the Confederacy are commemorating white supremacy. Full stop. That's really what they are about. If you look at when they are erected, they're erected during Jim Crow and in the middle of the 20th century. They are not erected right after the Civil War. These are statements made to reaffirm white supremacy as the ruling ideology of the land. So there's an unambiguous kind of quality to those statues. Other statues may signify more ambiguous things or places where there's really more of a range of opinions and interpretations. But I think it comes down to a choice about what stories and what figures does this country want to hold up as representative of its essence. And if you're holding up people who enslaved others, like Faneuil, for example, like Columbus, for example, that's a narrative that really shouldn't be what we in the United States aspire to.
Let me give you a little bit of sound from a couple of voices on the question of the Columbus statue. We heard from Jean-Luc Perrit, president of the board of directors of the North American Indian Center of Boston. To him, the statue of Christopher Columbus is a representation of a legacy and history of violence and discrimination against Black and Indigenous people for centuries. He says these local actions against monuments are a cry for recognition of that injustice.
So when we see some of these more extreme actions that really do get the message across, what's really being conveyed is, hey, there is a side of the story that no one is paying attention to that absolutely needs to be heard.
So, Michael, a monument really often will only tell one side of a story. How does one get the other side told?
Well, I actually think that we don't lack for opportunities to hear that other side. There are plenty of ways. And let's not even talk about, right, the indigenous side of the story where you're hearing from those voices. You can read Columbus's own words about what he stood for, the way he talked about the folks that he encountered when he crossed the ocean. They are vile. They are immoral. And they should be quite upsetting to anyone. So really, if what you want to do is reckon with what Columbus himself stood for, you can go and read his words and read accounts of him in the moment, and there's no ambiguity there. And then I think what we heard from the comment was absolutely correct. Part of what happens when you elevate one narrative is you suppress another. And there's a long, long history of erasing and violently silencing the voices of Indigenous folks in the United States.
So we also talked with Frank Mazzaglia, chairman of the board of the Italian American Alliance, who said Columbus is a symbol of Italian American heritage and of discovery of a place of immense economic opportunity. But he brought a different kind of wrinkle into the discussion by pointing out that the statue, Michael, was paid for by private donors and they should have a say in what happens to it. Let's listen.
The people who donated it, many of them are still around. And the question is that they do have a stake as to what's going to happen to that statue. We understood and still feel that the statue can be repaired and brought back to its original place. And if not, we can also put it in some sort of private property and protect it there.
So, of course, part of this is having a conversation about how we get a monument in the first place. Who decides we need one? Where does it come from? Where does it go? What does it represent? What should one think about who pays for it, where it's situated, and who has the right to make a call about the public appearance or the public presence of a monument?
Right. Well, that's not uncommon. I mean, so many of the monuments in this country, in this city, in Washington, D.C., really are private and public partnerships. But the public part of that shouldn't be underplayed or shouldn't be subservient to the private interest, right? Does it serve the public good to have these monuments erected in these public spaces? That's the question we fundamentally have to answer. If it's a question of compensation for those who paid for the monument to be installed in the first place, I'm sure we can work something out. The other part of this comment that I think is instructive here is the gentleman actually suggested or at least acknowledged that it might be possible to move it to a private space, right? And that I think is a different question from whether or not we want something in a public square, right? Because putting something in a public square suggests that it is aligned with the public good. Displaying it in private doesn't suggest that at all. So I think an openness to that kind of solution in cases like this is really important.
Let's grab at least one call here. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Nicole on the line from Hyde Park. Nicole, go ahead.
I'm calling because I go downtown for meetings for work, and I go by the Lincoln statue, and every time I walk by, it feels like a fresh piece of humiliation. And you could just see this Lincoln standing there, very erect, very dignified. But then when you get to the portion of the statue where it represents freedom for a black person, he's actually on his knees with Lincoln kind of patting his head, kind of in this whole white paternalistic way, like, I'm their savior. So I don't really feel like it's a statue that recognizes the liberation of black people. It feels like humiliation and subjugation, even though it's supposed to represent emancipation. Thank you.
Nicole, do you feel it should come down?
I believe it should. And I believe more of those statues should come down, but they should be put in a museum and set aside so that young people could go in there later on and learn about the real history of the United States. So I don't think they should be destroyed. I think they should be set aside just somewhere else where other people could go and see them. But certainly to take them out of the public square, because as the person said earlier, when they're in the public square, it suggests that it's for the public good, and it's not always that way.
Nicole, thank you so much for your call. I'm going to add one other caller here, 1-800-423-8255. We have Jeff on the line from the South End. Jeff, go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. Just one thing. There's something perhaps we can learn from Germany, as they have done very commendable things to try to reconcile what they did in World War II. I've seen in Germany where they keep statues or they keep areas like a burnt down synagogue, and they will use those as teaching tools. For instance, I had an experience where I was in a small town in Germany once and noticed a group of students around a vacant lot. And it turns out that what they were doing is they were high school students, and they come once a year, a senior class, and they come to this burnt-out synagogue, and they have a day-long vigil, and they learn about what Germany did in World War II. it's a very good opportunity to teach. So that's my
point. Jeff, I'm going to take it back from you there. Yeah, that's a great illustration and a really interesting bookend to the previous caller. So let me turn back to you, Michael Jeffries, to give you a chance to react to both of those things and put those messages together.
Yeah, I think I'll start with the second one. And I think that's actually a perfectly fine suggestion. I mean, part of what we're hitting on here is that not all of these monuments actually teach us anything. Many of them are just statues of folks, and we're supposed to infer something about the value of who these historical figures were merely from the fact that they're out here in public. So if we were really committed to the teaching enterprise, that opens up a new world of possibilities, right? Building teaching materials around these monuments, taking them off of the street and putting them in museums, as the first caller suggested. If that's really the goal, we have to commit ourselves to that part of it rather than just leaving them up there and allowing us, the kind of public who doesn't have the time or the wherewithal or has never really been introduced to the history, to guess about why these figures are so important.
So I'm going to pick up, Nicole was the caller before that from Hyde Park, and she was talking about the way she felt when she saw the Freedmen's Memorial in Boston each time she saw it. I want to give you a little more sound from another person on that. It's Tory Bullock, an artist. He started a petition calling for Boston to take it down. It depicts, let me be clear about this, Abraham Lincoln freeing an unnamed African-American man who is on his knees, kneeling to Lincoln. And Bullock says in a video that the depiction is offensive.
Does that make you feel respected? Does that make you feel good? Now, you want to know a sad truth? A sad truth is that this thing is able to stay up and able to have a bunch of tourists still to this day come and take a bunch of pictures and stuff with it. Because being completely real, given my experience, is how a lot of white people actually view black people.
So one of the things that's interesting about using the Freedmen's Memorial in particular is the idea that one should celebrate emancipation does not seem particularly controversial. And yet the depiction, the art of it, seems to mean everything in terms of how people experience it. So what is the relationship and how do we think about the difference between the purpose of a monument and the actual physical manifestation of that monument, which is, of course, full of lots and lots of choices by an artist or the people who pick the art?
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. And for those listeners who haven't actually seen the monument that we're talking about, the Lincoln one in the city, I mean, you have to actually take a look at it to understand how easily it could be read as just what the caller described, right? A very paternalistic, almost insulting representation of emancipation. And I think one of the ways to push back against some of these problems or prevent some of these problems is to really seek out the input of the communities whose stories these monuments are trying to tell before the artist is commissioned to depict them, right? The one of Lincoln is just a copy of one in DC, essentially. It wasn't really the product of any real dialogue with community members, Black community members in Boston or other places. So I think we need to have much more of an open dialogue and collaborative conversation when it comes to the artistic representation and the themes that we're trying to communicate with these pieces of art.
Let's grab another call here, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Constance on the line all the way from Pasadena, California. Constance, hello there. What's on your mind?
Hello. Well, I would like to point out the ambiguity of the argument because the monument to Emmett Till has been shot and defaced regularly for years. And for those who think that history should be left alone, I question the motivation of those who say we shouldn't take down one racist monument and still deface the one that is the ultimate monument to racism in this country.
So is your concern, Constant, about how to think about the act of defacing monuments? Is that what your focus is?
My point is that both acts, having a Confederate monument up and defacing Emmett Till, are both the ultimate acts of racism in this country, and they need to be compared one to the other.
Okay, thanks for that call, Constance. I'd like to add one other voice here. We've got Juan on the line from Haverhill. Juan, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Well, I was born in this country. I am an American citizen, but I was raised in Venezuela, and I came here a long time ago. But one of the things that I noticed over time, they, you know, and I'm going to just focus on Christopher Columbus' statue in the that was decapitated. You know, honestly, I mean, the guy came to this continent in the search of the Indies, India, China, because the route to the east was blocked by the Ottoman Empire. So Spain had the idea, well, let's go the other way, and Christopher Columbus knew the world was not flat. The world was round, and he ended up in the Bahamas. The poor guy died in 1506, not even knowing he had discovered a new continent. Everything that happened in the last 450 years is not to blame Christopher Columbus. It's to blame whoever the colonists were, Spaniards, French, English, Dutch, or anyone who imported slaves should be sort of blamed for. So
Juan, I'm going to pick it up from you there. Thank you, because there's a chunk of point there that I want to make sure that we don't miss. So thank you for that call. Let's go in reverse order on those, Michael Jeffries. Let's start with Juan. I think he's arguing, and we have heard this argument from others, that the Columbus statue was a lightning rod for real issues, but not Columbus's issues. Yet earlier in the segment, I heard, you know, you say very clearly that if you go back and read Columbus's writings, that is not the case. So what's your reaction to Juan?
Columbus was an enslaver. Columbus mutilated some of the folk. Columbus and his crew mutilated some of the folks that they met on their journeys. Columbus didn't discover something that didn't exist before he set foot there. There were already thriving societies and nations before Columbus arrived. So this notion that he discovered, this notion that he's not really responsible for slavery, that's just simply historically inaccurate. And I'm having a little bit of trouble with the first call about the Emmett Till monument versus the other monuments. I think the caller was simply urging us to pay attention to those cases where monuments are there for the correct reason, but we don't really utilize them and protect them as best we should.
And so let's pick up on that a little bit, because another question that Constance's call made me think of was the act of defacing monuments. Our very first caller in this segment suggested that people who had defaced, I believe it was the Columbus Monument, ought to be prosecuted. So how does one think about the act of defacing a monument? Often it's also a piece of protest or public expression about what that monument represents.
That's a good question. I think this is one of those cases where we need to allow for some discretion when it comes to the criminal justice system, when it comes to figuring out what the appropriate restitution or way to address these acts actually is. Because we have all sorts of other instances where crimes of vandalism are treated very different ways because of judicial discretion and just kind of local flexibility in the laws. And I think this is one of the places where we need to deploy that flexibility so that we can really do justice here, right? Not all kinds of vandalism are the same. And these cases where statues are coming down, after they've come down, essentially municipalities have said that the protesters are making the right decision. So I think we need to learn from those instances as well.
So one of the examples that we gave at the very beginning of this segment, Michael, was not a monument. It was about naming. And that is the push to rename Faneuil Hall. Kevin Peterson is the founder of the New Democracy Coalition, leading the push to change the name of Faneuil Hall. Kevin Peterson says that push for the name change is directly a part of a wider struggle. Here he is.
So the changing of the name process is proxy for having a deeper discussion around the pervasiveness of white supremacy that that hurts all of us as citizens. The symbolic effort around name changing is synonymous with other substantive discussions around policy change with regard to how Blacks are poorly treated in this nation.
So there's a lot there that we can unpack, Michael, and I want to pull out a couple of pieces of it. I think the first is that it's not just monuments. Naming is a big thing. We heard the discussion last week at the federal level about whether or not to rename some military bases that were named after Confederate figures. Is naming the same kind of historical power, or does it signal the same things in the public sphere as a physical statue, that physical manifestation does?
I wouldn't say they're exactly the same, but they're certainly similar. I mean, you think about the ways that names both uncover and hide history, right? How many places, how many states do we have that are actually names given by Indigenous Americans that we don't even know that's where they come from, right? Or, and on the flip side, the names that we do understand the etymology and the history of, we know them because we're taught that those histories are important. So I think we do need to attend to the historical significance of naming. And I liked what the gentleman said about the connection between the name controversy and a much broader struggle in terms of the impact and the reality of white supremacy. And it speaks to the point the first caller made, which is that we can't just think that making these symbolic changes are going to solve the structural problems of white supremacy and racism. But we have to understand that they are linked, because we can't continue to lie to ourselves about the racism that's baked into this country.
So our call lines are full. We won't have time to get to any more callers today because we only have about 2 minutes left, maybe about a minute for conversation. But callers, I do thank you for engaging in this conversation so deeply. The other thing I wanted to pick up on, Michael, was Kevin Peterson's emphasis on having a deeper discussion. When a monument or a choice of a name is deeply controversial and that pain is out there, what is at least the possibility of having a deeper discussion about that pain that advances our public understanding and public education? And how do we think about doing that?
Well, I think one of the ways to do it is, frankly, what we're doing right now, right on the airwaves. I think media has a very important role to play in cultivating that discussion around the country. And we've also seen it at the municipal level. In the state of Virginia, there are several municipalities and cities that are now revisiting their policies and the kinds of statues and monuments that they have up, and opening up those conversations between citizens and local governments to figure out, what's the best path forward? Is it to take the monument down? Is it to add an educational component to the monument? Is it to take the monument and put it in a museum? So those are two places where I think these conversations need to happen, in our legislative halls, where citizens can go and have their voice heard, and also on the airwaves.
And that's Michael Jeffries, Associate Professor of American Studies at Wellesley. So much to talk about here. I really appreciate you joining us. Thanks.
Thank you.